This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
All right, let's talk about the Renaissance and its different manifestations. Leo X, one of the Medici popes, along with numerous ones, were patrons of the arts, very interested in continuing to increase the buildings there in Rome and the artwork in the Sistine Chapel. And Rome was quite a place to behold. And a part of this this movement known as the Renaissance humanism of the 15th century is going to carry over into the 16th century, and particularly in its northern version through what we call Christian humanism. But there are a number of, before I get to the slide on the principles, here's just an overview of some of the individuals, that names that are known to a lot of us, architects, sculptors, painters from that era. These are many of these names would be ones that you're familiar with. But what tied the Renaissance humanism together was its commitment to some basic principles that began to emerge, not the least of which is this reverence for classical antiquity. And this notion that particularly the Greco-Roman culture, classical culture, had much to offer the 15th century society. Whether it be philosophical ideas, going back to Plato, Aristotle, the other philosophers, the ethical opinions, law, architecture, views on education. And one of the individuals that drew a lot of attention was the ancient Greek Cicero, and his commitment to studia humanitas, the study of humanity. And this kind of garnered a lot of attention, that really what it meant to be truly educated, to be truly human, was to understand fully what it means to be a human being, as an active citizen and someone who's involved in all the liberal arts. And one of the ways to do this is by re-engaging with classical literature. And so this was a primary value. And the good news of this for the Protestant movement was what was a part of this reconnection with the old text, but the early church fathers. And an interest again in looking at the original manuscripts of Greek and Hebrews. They're looking at a lot of these ancient Greek and Latin texts from the Greco-Roman era. And so renewed interest in looking at the Holy Scriptures, renewed interest in reading the Fathers, and as some of these Renaissance scholars began to recognize as they immersed themselves in the writing of the scholars, in the writing of the Church Fathers, is they recognized that the expression of Christianity in their own day looked rather different from the way it was described among the fathers of the earlier centuries. And so that, for many of them, was a clarion call to go back to the what they considered more the pure era of the church. The emphasis on the simple doctrine and the piety, ethical life. And so there's kind of a mixture of these ideas, looking at ancient philosophy, reconnecting with the church fathers, looking at the biblical text, and for a number of these scholars, it was a matter of bringing these different strains together in their trying to understand what it meant to be a humanist. All right, an acquired sense of historical judgment, ad fontes to the sources. And here, an interest in actually favoring some of the documents of antiquity, seeing that there are both continuities and discontinuities with ancient times, but that there was a pristine value in these older documents. And you get this concept, which was first articulated by Petrarch in the 14th century, of the Dark Ages. He was not the only one to use that expression, but this notion of the truth that the ancients had discerned and how it had been lost in this period of darkness or the Middle Ages. And now at the time of Renaissance, a time of rediscovery. And their conviction that there was a real continuity, although distant in time, closeness in sentiment. Although distant in time, closeness of sentiment of the Renaissance with the ancient world. Thirdly, human beings at the center of creation. This understanding of that human beings not only are creatures but are to be creators and to develop fully what it means to be human and that creative aspect of what it means to be a person. Emphasizing the individual, the human potential. One of the things that the Italian Renaissance particularly highlighted was the free will of man to be all that he or she can be. And this is, a sense of what it means to be fully human and understand how we are unique and what we're to experience in life. And then fourthly, humanitas acquired by intellectual pursuit. A lot of emphasis on study, education, the Greek and Latin classics, renewed interest in the study of rhetoric, that kind of thing. Well, just simply, these would be some of the principles, common principles that underlay this Renaissance movement, if you would, in understanding of humanism. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about uniquely Christian humanism, how there were some in the church who wanted to engage with some of the ideas that were emerging out of the Italian Renaissance, but particularly wanted to put a Christian angle on it and try to integrate it into the faith. So we'll see how that that plays out. One of the interesting Italians was Lorenzo Valla, and he was one who Luther thought a lot about. And you can understand why, because he was one of these Renaissance men, if you would, who did not hesitate to call it like he saw it. And when he saw corruption in the church, whether it be in the papacy or immorality, that kind of thing, he spoke about it, very open in his criticism. He criticized the Latin Vulgate as not a very good text at all. There were certain significant errors in it. Well, in addition to his philosophical works and critique of the church, one of the things that he exposed as a part of his own scholarship is that this little document back from the 8th, 9th century known as the Donation of Constantine was a forgery. This particular document purported to be a gift that Constantine, the great emperor of Rome, this now Christian emperor, had given to the Pope, that he had given the land of the Papal States, and that this property had come down from Constantine himself. And through using textual, critical, historical methodology, Valla was able to demonstrate, really beyond doubt, that this had been a forgery. And it had been a document that had surfaced to support papal claims, but certainly could not be traced back to the 4th century. And so that was obviously was of significant embarrassment to the church as a whole, because it was something that had been a part of the folklore, if you would, of Christendom up until this time, that the great emperor had given all this to the Bishop of Rome. But Valla showed that was wrong. Now, what we call the Northern Renaissance, I want to pick three individuals and talk about their contributions and how they would have some connections to some of the early Protestant leaders. Now, this Northern Renaissance is what we typically refer to as Christian humanism. Now just get out of your mind this notion that we banter back and forth about secular humanism, okay? Don't take the word humanism as necessarily a bad term. Again, remember, studia humanitas, the study of man, trying to understand from a Christian viewpoint what it means to be fully human as God made us. That was a part of the idea of these Christian humanists, a part of this trend to want to reconnect with what it had meant to be Christian down through the ages. I want to talk about three individuals in England, John Colet, and then Lefebvre Etaple, sometimes just called Lefebvre in France, and then probably the most significant of all would be Erasmus. Let me just say a few things about these three. I think you'll find it interesting the overlap in their lives and the kinds of things that they were involved with. There were a number of these Christian humanists in England, particularly in the University of Oxford. Men that had sometimes studied in Italy, had been exposed to much of what the Italian Renaissance was about, had brought these ideas back to Oxford, began teaching these things to their students, this revival of classicism, and particularly looking in the English context of looking again at ancient biblical Christianity. So a more biblical humanism developed. Focus on the scriptures and the church fathers. Now, Colet in London set up a school known as St. Paul's School there at St. Paul's Cathedral in London, which is to this day still the seat of the Bishop of London, and tried to model what he did there on some of the schools that he had observed in Italy, this new learning that was being available. And one of the things that he began in 1496 was to lecture on the Book of Romans at Oxford. And there was a lot of interest in St. Paul in applying this new humanist scholarship and getting away from the old allegorical method of interpretation, which had become popular in the late medieval schools. Looking at analogy and allegory and sometimes tended to neglect the literal meaning of the text. And so what Colet was encouraging his students here at Oxford to do, let's look at the New Testament in the light of St. Paul's context, the first century. It's the same kind of thing we do today. But these guys were beginning to practice historical critical and historical contextual exegesis. And looking at the grammar, looking at the language, the time in which it was written, that kind of thing, and to try to discern the an adequate literal interpretation of the text away from all these allegorical glosses that the medieval scholastics had imposed upon the text. And he was one that said, you know, Aquinas has tainted Christianity with philosophy. That's certainly a note that Luther would pick up on. Well, Colet did emphasize, obviously, if he's studying Romans, the importance of sin and grace, but still being a Renaissance man, put a great emphasis on the free will and nobility of humanity. Very Catholic in his theology, but addressing some of the abuses that he saw in the church. But that would be very important there in England in laying some of the bedrock. You'll notice Colet dies in 1519. So his life just barely overlaps coming up to the early years. But again, because of the printing press, these ideas, there's cross-semination all over Europe, Britain, and so Colet's important. Now, Lefebvre in France is also very significant. Interestingly, guess what he's lecturing to his students on in Paris? Book of Romans. Same thing. St. Paul, again, draws particular attention. And he had been a parish priest, had gotten his doctorate at the University of Paris and began to teach there. He was enamored by Aristotle, as most of the medieval men were. And his particular take on things, trying to renovate Aristotle, where he felt like he had not been understood fully, but One of his contributions, in addition to his work on the book of Romans and writing a commentary on that by 1512, is he worked on a document known as the Psalterium Quintuplex, which was five Latin versions of the Psalms. There had been different versions of the Psalms, which he collated in the Psalter. And this is what Luther would use when he was giving his lectures on the Psalms when he had his evangelical awakening, if you would. It was his second time through the Psalms. And so here you've got a French scholar who had worked on this collation of the Latin text of the Psalms, which Luther is going to be using later in Wittenberg, which are going to be instrumental in him coming to understand the gospel in a fresh way. So some connections there. Lefebvre is one that John Calvin would seek out as a young scholar before he had to flee France. When the temperature is turned up and the persecution of Protestants is beginning to take place and some of them have been killed, Calvin has to flee, as many of the French Protestants do. But when in his younger days, he does avail himself of going to Lefebvre for advice and learning from him. Lefebvre had also, interestingly, under the auspices of the King of France, Francis I, translated the Bible into French. And Francis I, we're going to learn, who was in pitted against Charles V of the Holy Roman Empire in warfare over about a 30-40-year period. Once this Protestant movement gets a little bigger, you're going to find him being a little more resistant toward the Protestant movement there. And we'll talk about the French Reformation later and what kind of tipped the scales ultimately. But early on, you see him being a patron of this scholarship and open to his people having the Bible in French. Later on, though, Lefebvre is going to have to flee France because of some of the warfare that's going on that had an impact on him. But later he will be recalled to France. A woman I'll just mention. Some of you ladies, I know my class in Atlanta, some of them were interested in who are some of the women of the Reformation you might want to study. Marguerite of Navarre. Marguerite of Navarre. Was a noble woman who was a great supporter of the early Protestant movement. Highly educated woman, knew Latin and Greek, and she is the one who particularly helped Lefebvre in his later years. It was under her umbrella that he was safe and was able to continue his work. But you might look and see if you're interested in one of the women of the Reformation. She would be one you could perhaps find some stuff on. Let me just mention this. I apologize. I cannot remember the title of this book, but Roland Bainton, B-A-I-N-T-O-N, who wrote the famous biography of Luther, Here I Stand, he has written a book on the women of the Reformation. And it has been, I do not have a copy of that. I don't think our library does. It's been so long since I've seen it. The title slips me. But if you look up, Reformation and women in Roland Bainton, maybe you can find that. But some of you, if you're interested, and I think there are biographies in that work on four or five significant women of the Reformation era. But Marguerite of Navarre would certainly be one. All right, now let's talk about good old Erasmus, who becomes, if nothing else, the one who would get Luther out of the blocks, if you would. It would be said about Erasmus that Erasmus laid the egg that Luther hatched, to which Erasmus responded, yes, but a gamecock was hatched, because he was not too happy about what Luther did. And the longer things went on, he became more and more bitter about that. But definitely some connections there. But let's talk about the great Desiderius Erasmus. He was born in Rotterdam, and he was orphaned as a young man, and as I mentioned earlier, was raised by one of the communities of the Brethren of the Common Life. And so he was exposed to that emphasis on Christian piety, and he had been obviously immersed in the context of the study of God's Word, the Scriptures, which was common in these communities of the Brethren of the Common Life. He was ordained to the priesthood eventually and then pursued his studies at the University of Paris. By 1495, he had earned his degree studying classical letters and the fathers. And if there's one individual who stands out as the most prominent humanist scholar, particularly Christian humanist scholar of the Reformation era, it would be Erasmus. And it got to the point he became so well known, his massive writings published and spread all over Europe, that he was just in demand all over, and spent his life traveling. Spent a lot of time in England, teaching at the universities there. Spent time in France, Germany, just all over Europe, and very prominent individual, and is going to be drawn into the vortex of the upheaval that the German Protestant ideas were developing, and eventually he is going to be pitted against Luther in a number of different ways, and he is going to resist this because his whole thing was, as scholars, let's have these conversations in private behind closed doors. This is the way scholars operate. But he was drawn into public debate in writing with Luther because pressure was put on him. He was, since he was the preeminent scholar in the church, a lot of pressure was put on him to deal with Luther. And we'll talk about that interaction between Erasmus and Luther eventually. But let me say a few things about him. This notion of the philosophy of Christ, this was the approach that Erasmus tried to bring to the table in terms of his platform for reform in the church. He, along with these other Renaissance and humanist scholars, was very vocal about his dismay of what he saw in the church of his day. Things are seriously awry, and they have got to be dealt with. And so this philosophy of Christ he put forward, and essentially it was his program for how to return the church to ethical values. You know, in our own time, we hear about, we need to return to family values. Well, this is a part of what he was saying. We need to return to our Christian family values. And so he not only draws them back to the writings of the church fathers, but also he felt like that the much of the ancient Roman and Greek ethical literature had a lot to say about forming young people in their worldview and understanding of what it meant to be an ethical person. So the love of wisdom in trying to return, as he said, to the more non-scholastic tradition of the church, back when the emphasis of the ancient church on following Christ and meditation on the sacred page. So a non-scholastic Christianity which put emphasis on the reading and implementation of Scripture. Sounds pretty Protestant, doesn't it? I mean, this is a part of what men like Collet and Lefebvre were advocating. And he was against all this speculative scholastic theology, and we need to go back to a simpler day. And he, part of what his program was about was the ethical reform. And he felt like through the disciplines of classical study, we can reform education, teach the young people, and in the universities have them study these texts, and we can help rehabilitate the church and culture. And we live at a time where these ideas can be propagated because of the prevalence of printing and make these ancient materials available. And this can help bring about reform of the church. Now, to give you an example of one of his early publications, and I'm just going to scratch the surface on mentioning some of his more important, because I mean there were just a boatload of things that he did, particularly all of his editions of the church fathers. But the Adagia was a collection of Greek and Latin proverbs. Okay, that kind of fits with his paradigm, doesn't it? What is the ancient wisdom that we can use to direct us on how to live a moral, ethical life? And there were six editions of this work. The first edition came out in 1500. And he's going to be expanding it, adding commentary. And this is the fruit of his study of the ethical literature from the ancient world. And there were other works that he gave himself to that emphasized moral instruction. The Enchiridion is one that's significant for him. The 1503, the first edition, likewise be later editions, known as the Handbook of the Christian Knight. The Handbook of the Christian Knight. And this basically was a manual on Christian living and personal discipline and what it meant to follow Christ as a layperson. And again, coming out of this Brethren of the Common Life movement, an idea that you serve Christ in your vocation where you are. But it was, again, underscored this back to the Bible, back to the Fathers kind of thing. The editions of the Fathers, and I could list many of them, but particularly in the first 5 or 6 centuries of the church, what we call the patristic period, okay? The ancient church fathers, many editions of these, of all the well-known names you would know. And then probably the work that is forever identified with Erasmus is his Greek New Testament of 1516. And as scholars have pointed out, this particular text is going to set the foundation for biblical scholarship for almost 300 years. Because Erasmus goes back now and avails himself of some of the best manuscripts that the Renaissance men had helped re-explore, and through comparative study of the text with his own marginal notes and his work, trying to put together a solid Greek New Testament, wrote a preface to it, and so had his input. And a second edition of this in 1519 is going to be the basis of Luther's German Bible. So this particularly is a connection to Luther. And Beza's Greek New Testament. Beza will follow Calvin in Geneva. Will also be influenced by Erasmus's work, as was Tyndale in Britain. All right, and Praise of Folly is a good illustration of how he critiqued the church world of his day. And this is kind of an intriguing satire. I remember years ago I had a student read in Praise of Folly doing some work on Erasmus, and she found that quite an intriguing work. It's a satire, essentially, showing the foolishness of the church and all the things that go on in the church, the superstition that are so rampant, and in these things he put in this creative narrative, so that in effect using this satire to critique the monks in the church. I got a couple of images up here. Here's a woodcut from the book in Praise of Folly. The soul of a monk enters the body of folly. And the monks are kind of the butt of the whole book, if you would. Here are these fools and that living this this life of shallowness and just the emptiness of it all. Another woodcut from In Praise of Folly is a simple peasant worshiping an icon. You know, how reasonable is that? And so very influential book, though. And, you know, Erasmus has got the official censors of the church looking over his shoulders. And because of the preeminence of this scholar, he was protected and didn't pay for his vices with his head, as so many would later. But they kept their eye on him because he was a prominent critic of the church. And then at the bottom there, I'll just list, and I'm going to come back and talk about this later when I talk about Luther and his theology. I'll try to unpack it a little bit to talk about the debate in writing between Luther and Erasmus. But as I mentioned earlier, pressure is put on Erasmus to deal with Luther, and he writes this book, Diatribe de Libero, The Freedom of the Will, to which Luther is going to respond with his famous The Bondage of the Will in 1524. You know, at the end of his life, you know what Luther said, just to show you how important this bondage of the will, because Luther felt like that, you know, his esteemed adversary, Erasmus, had really hit the bullseye. And it's why Luther responded with such vehement language like he did in The Bondage of the Will. At the end of his life, after he'd written hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pieces, He said, if they were all destroyed, he said, the only thing I wish that will survive would be my catechisms, which teach small children, and the bondage of the will. Because this is the heart of the matter. So, a very contentious spirit evidence in that book. I never forget the first time I read, you can buy in paperback in the classic, let's see, the Library of Christian Classics. The Library of Christian Classics in the paperback series, you can actually get Erasmus's and Luther's book bound together in paperback. And I never forget reading the first time through that and getting the spirit of it, and you just kind of get a sense of the way these 16th century guys interacted with each other, but particularly in Luther's response. At the introduction, now this is not verbatim, but just by way of illustration, he lays it on thick. You know, dear, esteemed, most honored Erasmus, the greatest scholar, beloved, honored, we kiss your feet. You know, we bow before you. And he goes on and on. And then he finally says, but Erasmus, you are a fool. Prop him up and then let him have it. But that's kind of the tone that's in there. But I'll come back to that when we get to Luther and talk about his theology a little bit. But it certainly is an important interaction between those two men. All right, finally, the political situation to set the context, particularly for Luther, because Luther is going to be born, raised, fulfill his ministry within the bounds of what is known to us as the Holy Roman Empire. So let me talk about this animal, what it was, how it was experienced, and what it had to do with Luther's lifetime. All right, the House of Habsburgs, you'll find it spelled both ways. Maybe somebody will explain to me which is the correct spelling, but in scholarly books you'll find it with a P or a B, so I just put them both up there and make everybody happy. But the House of Habsburg is the royal family that Charles V is a member of. And this particular ruling family in Europe goes back to the middle of the 15th century, and they are going to have control for about 350 years in this part of Central Europe. The empire spreads all the way from Spain in the west. I'm going to show you a map in a minute, for those of you who haven't seen the slides. From Spain in the west to Hungary and Bohemia in the east. Think of the city of Prague, okay? That's in Bohemia, all the way to the east, so a vast territory. And these Holy Roman emperors are going to particularly have hegemony in Germany all the way up until the time of Napoleon. But Charles V becomes the most powerful ruler in all of Europe and Britain because of the inheritance that he receives, not only from his maternal grandparents. I'll go on and put the map up there that you can see. Does he get Spain? The Yellow Territory is owned by the King of Spain. Ferdinand and Isabella are his maternal grandparents, but he's also, through other parts of his family line, going to have a part of this territory down in southern Italy. Austria is very important. One of his brothers is going to eventually be the ruler there. The Holy Roman Empire has its hand in the Netherlands, which will be a very contested area, particularly with France. But you get an idea in the yellow area of part of the kingdom that was a part of Charles V's domain. And then this dotted line is the Holy Roman Empire. And essentially this was a whole collection of German kings, particularly in princes in this area, and then also part of northern Italy, over which had made a commitment to be under Charles V's authority, and it was a confederation, if you would. And Charles had this vast domain that he was responsible for. If you look down at the bottom, a federated, supranational, multi-ethnic Holy Roman Empire. And even this term, Holy Roman Empire, the carryover from the from the ancient church. You know, that idea had been identified with Constantine a bit and the later Christian emperors beginning in the 4th century, that turning point, at least in the minds of medieval persons, of the year 800, when the king of the Franks, Charlemagne, was crowned the Holy Roman Emperor. And it was a vision, again, of a Christian empire, if you would. It's like, you know, the reinstituted great empire of Constantine with the Christian emperor. And so this concept had carried over. And so Charles V was a very committed Roman Catholic and in understood his duty to protect and preserve the faith. And he was frustrated like crazy with the proliferation of the Lutheran movement in his domain. And I'll describe to you his frustration, why he couldn't do a whole lot more, he couldn't do a whole lot with it. There were attempts, but the political situation was very important. It was a patriarchal monarchy. There were 7 of the princes which had elected Charles V to this position to make him the emperor. Imperial diets, that's going to be important. Several of those will make very determinative directions for the Protestant movement, where the princes and the emperor would get together. And then his main responsibility was to preserve peace, and that would be politically and religiously, and also for a common defense. And part of the issue with defense, not only is he going to be involved with battling other European heads, but look who is on the east of the Holy Roman Empire, the Ottoman Turks. And this is his big concern and has a bearing on what plays out in the Holy Roman Empire, because they do not have the luxury, particularly in the early decade or two, to deal effectively with this Protestant uprising, because they're busy raising armies to defend themselves against the Turks. All right, in addition to the Turks, to the east, he has these ongoing wars with the King of France. And so that preoccupies the time. You see there between 1521 and 1529, Francis I and Charles V have claims to a number of different areas of Europe. And Charles V is unable to really fight the Protestants, that is, militarily, until the Small Call War of 1546. So as you can tell, that is almost 30 years after Luther posted the 95 Theses. Now, can you imagine, 30 years later, this Protestant movement was huge. It was huge. And eventually, what is going to happen within the Holy Roman Empire? There were 65 imperial cities in the Holy Roman Empire. 65. By the middle of the 16th century, 50 of those imperial cities, 50 of the 65 cities were recognized Protestantism. So he would eventually kind of have his back up against the wall and have to negotiate and compromise in dealing with Protestants. You know, you're always hesitant, and as historians, you want to be careful about ever trying to interpret God's providence. And, you know, I'm always reminded about the Spanish Armada. You know, whether you are Philip II or Queen Elizabeth I, both of whom were worshipers of the one God, you know, which hand of providence do you see in that? But if I could just make this rather obvious comment, when you look at the political situation, and particularly where Charles V stood, not only with France, in combating Francis I, the battling in the Netherlands, they're fighting in parts of Germany, down here in southern Italy, this 20-30 years war, the Muslim threat, which they were absolutely terrified in Europe. You can see how politically the situation provided an environment in which this little Protestant movement could slowly grow. Because let me tell you, Charles V wanted to squash it. And he could have easily done it if he would have not been preoccupied with Francis I and the Ottoman Turks. He could have crushed it easily. They'd kill them all. That's what they did. when they needed to. And there were times when they would do that kind of thing. And so I think in the big picture of this, you know, as it's been said, Luther was the right man at the right time. And we'll talk about how he was the right man a little bit later as we get to that. Well, the Holy Roman Empire and that political situation, very significant. All right, and there you see Luther in the territory of Saxony. And his particular friend, prince, Frederick the Wise, is going to be supportive of Luther's idea and basically be able to provide some protection for him in those very early years. One of the realities that Charles V had to deal with, he didn't have trouble getting the Swiss mercenaries and the German troops from the princes to fight against the Turks. But he had a dickens of a time trying to get the Germans to fight against one another. The princes just were very hesitant to take up arms. There were times when they did, but they were hesitant to do that because they viewed themselves as brethren, as Germans, their ethnicity, and they were just hesitant to go after one another. But if we're going to go fight France, fight the Turks, no problem. And that, again, was a part of the reality of that situation. Now, I've already mentioned the fall of Constantinople, 1453, and how the Ottoman Empire was a very oppressive, and Europe was terrified of what might take place. But they were able to stop them in Vienna. I think the map shows the movement right up into Vienna. You notice the year 1529, and they had been able to be stopped here in North Africa. But so much of North Africa and the Middle East, the Ottoman Turks had gone in and taken over the Persian areas, Arabia, Egypt, and so very powerful army. But thankfully, Suleiman died in 1566 and did not have as worthy of successors who were able to continue with the militant movement. But Protestants were scared to death of them, no doubt about it. And Luther would write against the Turks, and you find references to them throughout the literature of the period because there was a big concern about that. All right. Well, that, yes.
Today, those were Muslims. That's when they took over the Persian, which is Iran.
Yes, the Ottomans were Sunnis. That's right. And yes, I mean, the lasting impact, it comes down to our own day. What happened in 1453 is a similar situation to what had transpired earlier at the time of the Crusades in the 10th and 11th century, and the Eastern Church is feeling this oppression from the Islamic hordes and is calling on the West to deliver them. And remember, I mentioned those last attempts to bring East and West together were kind of the last cry of the Eastern Church to get the West to help them, but they eventually were just overrun. And that picture, I still to this day cringe when I see that picture. That is Hagia Sophia. This is the great cathedral that Constantine himself began. This is the mother church of all of Eastern Christendom. And here are these minarets, these prayer towers on the four corners, and today it's just a museum. But, that's what happened in that part of the world. That's in the modern city of Istanbul, ancient city of Constantinople. But since the 15th century, it has been Islamic territory. That's one of the places I want to visit. I have never been there. I understand it's... I've seen pictures from the inside, and I want... Anybody been there in Turkey? I really want to someday. It's one of the magnificent buildings in the world. But it's just a museum, and you'll go in and you'll find Christian icons all over it, and you find Islamic symbols all over it.
kind of co-mixed together in there. And, you know, there was a lot of trouble here. Part of the Spanish Inquisition was against persecuted the interbred peoples that were Muslim and Christian. Is Islamic peoples had moved into some of this area before it was reconquered, and the Inquisition was pretty brutal against these people. So you don't want to suggest that Christians didn't do their part to be oppressive during this time. It's a very, very brutal era.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole for sale or for profit without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.